Welcome to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hemmerker. In each episode, she'll talk with your favorite romantic suspense authors. They will take you behind the scenes of the writing process, giving excerpts from their writing, and share stories about their writing life.
Limburger and Larceny by Marissa Masterson. Mystery and murder lurk behind the doors of this idyllic small town. A cheese shop, a strange business for a woman allergic to cheese. Still, her godmother leaves her the shop and a mystery. Julia Arnold adores the color pink and her old LeSabre. Those are the only two things that bring her happiness since her husband's passing. When she learns of her inheritance, she seizes on the chance to start a new life in Wisteria, Wisconsin. Soon after Julia arrives, strange things happen. From roaches to mice to late-night intruders, someone is attacking her business. Perhaps handsome Alex, the other heir, is behind the mischief. Or is it someone she would never expect to sabotage her new life? And what's the deal with the treasure supposedly buried in her basement? What begins as a new start in a charming small town rapidly morphs into a race to discover the villain's identity. Will she discover the face behind the vandalism before she is harmed?
On this episode of The Romantic Side of Suspense, I'm chatting with Marissa Masterson, who's written 65 books, and she lives in Michigan, and I'm so excited to talk about writing with her. So welcome to my show, Marissa.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So 65 books. I just have to ask, when did you start publishing?
2019. I had spent about 7 years healing, where I was no longer able to go into the classroom. And all the time of healing from the trauma I had. And after those 7 years, I said, what do I do with myself? I'm not going back into the classroom. And I started proofreading and editing for other authors, and ideas just lit up in my mind, and from there I started writing my own books.
Wow, I love that. That is so much fun. So what did you want to be as a child? Did you want to be a writer, or it sounds like you were a teacher as well? And did your dream as a kid come true?
Both of them, yes. I wanted to be a teacher. Always wanted to be a teacher. And I did spend 22 years in the classroom before my spinal cord injury and other issues, health issues, sidelined me. But I also wanted to write. I thought, oh, to be able to write a book, everyone will remember my name if I write a book. That was as a child. Of course, as an adult, you think, Lord, what do you have for me? And how can I use this gift of encouragement that I have and this gift of wanting to reach out to people, the connection? And so that's what became more important than just having a name out there.
Yes. So what is one of your favorite ways to connect with readers? I mean, obviously through your book, but how else do you connect with them?
I run a Facebook group called Sweet Wild West Reads. And I'm on there several times a week connecting with readers. I also have a newsletter. And I go to Florida every year. And whenever we can, other authors and I try to have a reader luncheon down there. Oh, I love the reader luncheons when I can see the readers face-to-face and give away free books. That's always fun.
Oh, that's a great idea. So how many authors do you generally get together for those?
We usually have three or four that are down there. There's another author, Marlene Beerworth. She's a Canadian author. She always winters in Florida. And so she and I meet up. Danny Rowan, we usually meet up with. And sometimes Lynn Coleman, who's another Bethany House author, I believe, at one time, she will join us too. And so it's wonderful to be able to get together with them, but also for the readers too. And so we've got a meetup planned, and I don't know, we haven't opened it yet to the readers, but in Lakeland, Florida. We're going to be meeting up on February 4th.
So what kind of questions do you get from readers when you do these, like, in-person things?
Questions, boy, my mind is just going blank as far as questions. A lot of times it's just talking to each other, not about my books necessarily, but about the things we've been doing, that are occupy our lives.
Okay.
And
all
really
right.
Bringing that personal touch to it. And many times the readers that I see down there are readers that have contacted me through Facebook already. So they might be my beta readers, especially my beta readers if they're down in Florida, they'll come. And so we know each other's lives a little bit anyhow. So we are kind of catching up on each other's children, what they're doing and such.
Yeah, that's lovely. I love that because, you know, one of my favorite things is when, you know, you meet a reader and then you meet them again and you can have that little bit of that relationship with them and you can kind of share things. That makes it, I think, so much so special. So that's really great that you have an annual kind of thing that you can do that connection with.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And, of course, I'm always willing to talk about my granddaughter. So.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So let's switch to your characters. And how do you connect with the characters that you write about? What kind of things do you do to get to know them?
I have a 6-question list that I complete before I ever sit down to write a book. And I do it for both my main male character and my main female character. It's a list that includes, what are they afraid of? What has happened to them in the past that was their dark moment? The thing that's really set them on the path that they are on. I start to think about, once I know their dark moment, what will make this better? And it's how I can start to bring that character to life and imagine what plot is going to unwind for that character, if that makes sense.
It does. And do you do that just for your hero and heroine? Do you do it for the villain, the secondary characters? How deep do you go with these kind of questions?
You know, it depends on whether I want to do what is almost an interruption in the chapter. I do like to do these. The chapter will wind down, and then before the next chapter starts, I'll go from third person to a first person, and that first person is the villain speaking. So we can get a hint into the villain's mind. And in that case, I like to know what's driving that villain, so I'll have done that. I did that style in a couple of my books. I don't do it often, but the readers love it when I do it. I don't know why I don't always do it, but it's just something that doesn't always seem to fit.
Right, and I appreciate that you're not trying to shoehorn in, you know, a literary device like the first person point of view of a villain into a story that it just doesn't fit. I mean, I think that that's important to keep in mind. You know, some books are meant just to have 2 points of view. Some of them, you need that an extra 1 or 2 or 3. You know, some maybe just 1 point of view. So I think it's important when we're thinking about the story as a whole to take that in consideration as we're writing.
Really, yeah. Because you have to decide whose story is it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the main female character's story or the main male character's, or is it better told by letting the reader get an insight into each of them at a different point in the story? So that becomes important for me, to figure out who needs to speak at this time. Or who do I need to follow in their mind at this time? Because I do third person limited, I'll switch from the male to the female. Oftentimes giving the female a chapter and then the male a chapter, but the story flows. It doesn't stop to where they're retelling the same situation,
right,
the same events. Yeah.
Yeah, you move the story forward, just different
Definitely.
Perspectives. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally understand that. So, which brings to another kind of writing questions, accuracy. No matter what we're writing, we have to be accurate. So how do you kind of make sure that your books are not asking the reader to suspend too much of their belief as they write, as you read their story?
Yes. Well, and pardon me.
That's okay.
Because many of my books are historical. I research, because it drives readers bonkers if something comes in there that is not accurate. People know their history nowadays, and you can't expect people to accept contradictions when you want to become, when you expect the setting to draw you in. Such a contradiction will just ruin it for a reader. So I think research is so important, but also I have an editor who reads to make sure that I haven't contradicted, haven't used characters' names or or forgotten characters. Oh, I'm famous for forgetting characters' names. Oh, just famous. So that would ruin it too. And also, if it's a book in a series, because I do have series with several books, that the action in one book doesn't go against what happened in another book, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah, it's always good to keep that balance and to figure out, especially.
Yes.
You know, are you keeping the same eye color throughout? Do you have does she have long hair in chapter 1 but short hair in chapter 16 and she didn't get her
exactly.
haircut?
Exactly.
You know, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was it. I have a continuity editor.
Well, at least you know there. It. At least you know it, and now you can take steps to make sure that you can fix it. So, but when do you find time to write? I know you talked about how it sounds like you're home full time to write, but do you have specific times that you write better than?
Oh my, I have to, yes. Because I write at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
My writing time is between 4 and 8 in the morning. That's my peak time. I've always been an early morning person. I know I'm a strange duck, aren't I?
But just a little.
I loved having my intense literature classes that I taught right away in the morning because I was peppy and ready to go. But I also have a 6-year-old grandchild, and since she was a newborn, I have had her 12 hours a day until she went to school. So I had to do all my writing before she came in the morning. So I have structured my life around the writing and around her, so to speak.
Yeah, well, it works for you. I always love hearing about when writers can find time to write because, I would prefer to write in the mornings, but since I have a have a day job now, I can't. So I've had to learn to write early evenings, and that has been a change. But it hasn't been as bad as I thought it was going to be. So that's always positive. But sometimes we have to change. Yeah. We have to change when we write, and that's okay.
Yeah,
that's a different season.
Yeah. Yep. Sometimes you have to. Keep that notebook handy, though, even at the day job, and you might scroll down a few notes, and you might catch yourself making notes during that. What would be normally your peak time to write? It might just become your time that your mind is thinking a little bit about it and taking a few notes, and then you'll get to it later in the evening.
Yeah, that's true. That is definitely true. Well, we have time for one more question, I think. So tell me which of your books is your favorite and why this book is your favorite.
I love, it's called Alice Heals the Doctor. I wrote this book about a disabled heroine, one who devoted a lot of her 20s to taking care of her parents, and then an aging parent who passed away. She was born later in their lives. And when she was 30 years old, she decided she wasn't going to be stuck at home anymore, even though she had one leg that didn't work. And so she trained as a nurse, but none of the hospitals would take her. So she finds a way to use her nursing degree, and it takes her out to Kansas. And that's where the story starts. And through this, she also ends up with a mystery of who has caused the problem in this town, and who has killed the preacher, and so on. And so there is a whodunit along with it as well.
Ah, I love that. Well, thank you so much for sharing about writing, your books, and your process on my show today, Marissa.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Now an excerpt from Limburger and Larceny by Marissa Masterson. The dark-haired man seated across from her glared. Julia wanted to warn him about that. His handsome face might stay that way if he did not stop, or so she longed to tell him. Her mother often said that to her when she was a girl. However, Julia was not his mother. She supposed he had a good reason for his sour expression. He was as shocked as she had been by the contents of the will. The junior Mr. Holtz had read, "Into Julia Randolph Arnold, my goddaughter, I leave ownership of the Clover Blossom Cheese Shop, the building, land, and contents, on condition that she run the business for at least 5 years before selling it. She also must continue to sell the products for my farm's cheese factory for a 50% profit share. She also inherits the contents of the business's accounts up to the date that this will is read." The other heir jumped to his feet. "What? My aunt would never..." Holtz did not rise. He narrowed his gaze. "Sit down, Mr. Simmons. You inherit the farm and the money. Isn't that enough?" Alex Simmons huffed. "No. The farm and the shop are a set. Why would she..." The attorney did not let him finish. "Eileen had her reasons, God rest her soul, and she wanted to provide for both of you in her will." The nephew pointed a shaking finger in Julia's direction. "But to leave the shop to a pink-haired stranger!" "Really, Mr. Simmons, it was your aunt's choice. Can we finish?" "I suppose," he allowed as he plopped back down. "What do we do now, Holtz?" "Do? I finish the probate end of things for you, and you pay the inheritance tax. The will stipulates that you pay the tax for the shop as well as for your part of the inheritance, by the way." Like he had a spring in his behind, Alex jumped up again. "Pay her tax? Why me?" "It has to do with the tax levels and the lower amount you would pay versus what she would owe. Your aunt and my father figured it carefully when he drafted her will." Mr. Holtz did not urge the man to sit. He steepled his fingers and leaned back in his leather chair. "You may go. I am finished with you." He fixed his dark brown gaze on Alex. Julia watched rebellion flare in the other man's green eyes. Then Alex Simmons shrugged his shoulders. Without a goodbye, he stomped from the office. When the lawyer spoke, Julia thought what he said was intended for himself more than for her. "Strange man. We were in school together, and I hoped he had changed." One hand lifted to the back of his black hair. He slipped it lower and rubbed his neck. As if just remembering she was there, his gaze widened. Mrs. Arnold, my secretary will give you the keys to the cheese shop. Perhaps you might want to live in the 2 rooms near the back. They are vacant, though I don't know if Mr. Simmons left behind furniture when his aunt forced him to leave last month."
"Forced him out of the rooms? What happened?"
"It's not for me to say." His eyes traveled from her to the stack of papers on his desk and then back again. His message was clear. He was busy. "Thank you, Mr. Holtz." In the outer office, the middle-aged secretary looked away from her computer screen. "All set, then?" "I think so, except for the keys." She smiled. "Of course, here." A manila envelope with Aunt Ellie's name on it waited on the desk blotter. She handed it to Julia. "And can I ask why Aunt Ellie forced her nephew to vacate the rooms at the back of the shop?" The woman threw a worried glance toward the inner offices. Whatever she saw reassured her. She leaned across her desk, her voice falling as she confided what she knew.
The carnies say that money went missing. Eileen could prove it was her nephew, and then she made the appointment. Appointment? Carnies? With Mr. Holt Sr. to change her will. And Carnies is what we named our quilting group. Ignoring the bit about the sewing circle, Julia pushed for details about the will. What happened? The attorney said the will was 5 years old. The secretary snorted. Well, she died, didn't she? I guess so, Julia frowned. She died before she could make any changes? Exactly, and I can tell you that raised some eyebrows after I told people about her plan to change it. Julia's frown deepened. This confidential secretary was anything but discreet. She would remember that. You'll be busy enough at the shop. The farm factory produces Limburger, you know. Nowhere else in the United States makes it. The smell filled her mind like some of the stuff rested near her. Limburger and summer evenings under the old oak in her godmother's backyard. Mom and Ellie sat on top of the picnic table with their feet resting on the bench. They held sandwiches made of dark bread and stinky cheese, with glasses of dark beer waiting close by. She had refused to try this stuff and nibbled on bits pulled from the string cheese she held. The woman snapped her fingers and the memory evaporated. Mrs. Arnold, are you well? Julia smiled in response. Why does that mean I'll be busy? A button lit on the desk phone as an annoying buzz sounded. At the sound, the secretary sneaked a look at the closed office doors. When she returned her gaze to Julia, she smiled. The factory cannot sell the cheese. It legally has to go through the shop to reach customers. It's why the farm, the factory, and the shop are a set. Understanding lit the light bulb above Julia's head, like she was a character in a cartoon. Oh, Mr. Simmons mentioned something like that. I just bet he did. He's been bragging around.
Thanks for listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. You can sign up to receive notifications of upcoming podcasts and listen to previous editions at sarahhammerkerfiction.com.